So everybody just so we'll announce this again, but everybody just heard the recording in progress. All of these sessions are recorded. We just need to make sure that everybody knows that. So we're saying it out loud, coming from the robot and myself. So today we are really lucky to be joined by Niaz Dori. It's awesome that someone who is in touch with so much work across the country and the continent and the world is going to come give us the lowdown, and we'll get to have an exchange with her. We've been doing the Dirt and Democracy series for a couple
Henry,
months
I'm having
now.
just a little trouble hearing you. I don't know if your microphone is
Oh,
up or if
thank you.
anyone else is having that trouble.
I have a terrible microphone. How's that?
Better.
Okay, so we're recording. Hopefully everybody's cool with that. I said some nice stuff about Niaz, but I'll be saying some more nice stuff about her momentarily. And just by way of introduction to the series, the White River Natural Resources Conservation District, we've been doing the Dirt and Democracy series for about 2 months. Every other Sunday, we have cool, smart people come tell us about all kinds of things pertaining to the creation of an agrarian social movement, part of the movement for food sovereignty, which is essentially democratic community involvement in their food systems and control over the production, distribution, and consumption of food in their communities. So I think that is a common thread throughout all of the series. The next series we'll announce this again at the end. On the 18th, we'll be having Professor Sit Sui from the Global University out of China. She'll be actually joining us from Brazil to talk about the real rural reconstruction movement in China, which is really exciting. There's some amazing things happening there, and the Global University is a big part of it. So for folks just joining us, we're inviting everybody to drop their introductions into the chat. You can be as verbose as you like, and people can check out what you've got to say about yourself, and we can keep it moving. So before we hear from Niaz, we're going to hear from our own Jennifer Byrne talking about what the conservation districts are and whatever else she wants to tell us about. I'm excited to see. Take it away, Dr. Byrne.
Thank you so much. Just super quickly, by way of introduction, why we're doing this series. We work for the local Natural Resource Conservation District, one of the 14 districts here in Vermont. And a conservation district is essentially a watershed government. They can be county-based or watershed-based. And we've been hosting the series just to develop, kind of build our muscle around civic engagement, how democracy fits into our food system, and expand the understanding that conservation districts are here as very little known and underutilized infrastructure across all 57 US states and territories. And so we really want to uplift that. It's a mechanism for local decision making in soil, water, air, plants, animals, humans, and energy, to be exact, and the policies that it impact and the funding that gets distributed across all those resources. So that's what we're here to uplift. I would point everyone who's watching this right now to our YouTube channel if you're not already there. I'm going to put a link in the chat that will take you there that has all the previous Dirt and Democracy sessions, including our last session was a Conservation Districts 101 intro session that I highly recommend folks watch and learn about your local governments. So with that, I think the only other announcement that I'd love to share with you all, we have for 2 more days, we are accepting applications to our version of the new Working Lands Climate Corps. So we are accepting applications for Farm Force, and this is a paid certification program. It'll be a year long. It's a partnership with the Virgin Islands. Highly recommend it for any adults, young adults specifically, but there's no age cap right now, and so who are interested in learning how to help farmers farm and maybe farming themselves and getting paid while they get trained. So I think with that, I'll turn it over. Happy to talk more about this anytime.
Thanks, Jen. That was awesome. Yeah, join the Farm Forest cohort for a year. We're going to be doing a boot camp here in Vermont in September and then going to the Virgin Islands to see how the sausage is made in the territories in February, I think. So it'll be very engaging and fun. So today we have Niaz Dori with us. It is unreal to get to welcome you, Niaz, to be with our little crew here in Vermont. Niaz is the director of both the National Family Farm Coalition and the North American Marine Alliance. So food, land and sea, food sovereignty and leadership of by the producers and workers of those food and ecological systems. A quick blurb, since 1986, the National Family Farm Coalition has mobilized family farmers and ranchers to achieve fair prices, vibrant communities, and healthy foods free of corporate domination. That's what we're talking about. Through NFFC, folks like me who are members of Rural Vermont also enjoy membership in La Via Campesina, which is an international coalition of untold tens or hundreds of millions of peasant land workers, fisheries workers, and so many other elements of the food system. And because we understand that 60% of the world's food is still controlled by peasant producers, it offers a very interesting organizing opportunity to know that we've got that much power in what we consider to be a corporate dominated food system. So without yakking a bunch more at you, I'm really excited to turn it over to Niaz Dori. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Henry, for having me. And Jennifer, thank you for a little lesson in what the conservation district, where they are and what they do. I learned something today. Thank you for that. And well, I don't even know where to begin. There's so much to say. First of all, before I do begin, though, I'm thinking about all the folks in Vermont who have been hit by the latest flooding. I don't know how many of you are affected. These things have ripple effects, I know, no pun intended. I know that just because one place gets damaged, it doesn't mean the rest of the state isn't affected. In fact, we talk about waterways so often. When these floodings happen, what ends up happening way downstream is felt by a whole bunch of other people. So I hope that you're all faring well in this last, after this last storm. As Henry mentioned, first of all, let me tell you, I'm on a train. Occasionally, there might be somebody coming over the speaker to tell us something's about to happen. So if that happens, just ignore it and we'll keep going. And also the second thing I wanted to say is I would invite you, anybody who wants to raise a question or expand on a point as we're talking, to please do so as we go. We don't need to wait till the end for a question and answer thing. I kind of prefer not having a monologue, and it would be good to have an interaction. So please don't hesitate to jump in if something grabs your attention. As Henry, right on to you. I don't know if you can hear. You can hear it? Oh, good. Okay. Distracting for me, so I'm trying to ignore it. But as Henry mentioned, I'm with two organizations. I have the pleasure of serving the National Family Farm Coalition and the North American Marine Alliance. We've been in a shared leadership model for 6 years now, which is kind of hard to believe. And the shared leadership model came about because, unfortunately, the longtime director of National Family Farm Coalition, Kathy Ozer, that some of the folks in Vermont actually have known, passed away from cancer. And I was on the board at the time, and we were looking to see who's going to be our next executive director. And it was actually our friend, Carolyn Mugar, who is the executive director of PharmEd, sort of planted the seed of why don't you guys consider it a shared leadership model? You're kind of working on the same things. You're about the same size organization, and the synergy between what's happening on land and at sea could actually strengthen both organizations. And so, to make a long story short, that was a little bit over 6 years ago. And I've been lucky enough to be in this position. For me, the reason this work and being in this role made sense is even when I, way back when I started working on fisheries, which was 30 years ago, the thing that caught my attention was seeing the similarities between what I was hearing from fishing communities and what I had learned about farming communities back in California. And so even though at first it was a little bit of a struggle to see, as a community organizer, how do you organize fish or fishing people, once I saw the common denominators between that and the rest of our food system, it felt really easy to wrap my head around it. And then when I stepped into this role, it felt also easy to step into this role because I see not only the same opportunities, but the same challenges that fishermen face at sea as farmers do on land. As Henry mentioned, we've been around since 1986. We were born out of the farm crisis of the 80s. And I wish I could say that we had moved on to other issues, but unfortunately those crises are still with us. The economic injustices that farmers feel, whether it's about lack of fair prices or lack of infrastructure or lack of control really over your livelihoods. And those problems haven't gone away. If anything, for a lot of folks, they've exacerbated. There's been massive consolidation, as many of us know, massive loss of family farms, and particularly small and mid-scale farms. And all of this was sold to us as progress. And the idea of the Green Revolution being something revolutionary, and we're going to consolidate things and introduce efficiencies and feed the world. And we did all that. And the world is still going hungry, not because we don't have enough food, as you all know, but because food has become a political tool that many use to kind of play diplomacy, and which I would even hesitate to use that word. But as we're seeing around the world, food is held back in order to control people. And in many cases, we're seeing famine in places where there is fertile land and fishing grounds, because a lot of that food is being caught or raised and shipped elsewhere to places where people already have many options. None of this is anything you probably don't already know. And in many ways, if we just focused on that, we might all feel very helpless and hopeless that this kind of stuff continues to linger. And here we are. How many years is that? 86? How many years? 40 years, almost 40 years later, that we're still fighting the same fight. What is different is we know more than we did then. We've grown in our power. I feel like we're, you know, I was joking with Henry when you said plunging off the precipice. I said it's not a good thing to say to somebody who's on a train, but I feel like we are on a precipice. We're continuing to build power. We are exposing some of the big issues that are facing all of our food providers, whether they be people who are working on land or at sea. We're seeing the dynamics play out and repeat themselves over and over again. And so I feel like we have all the tools we need to coalesce around the common agenda. And that is a lot of the work that we do at the National Family Farm Coalition. We have technically 30 member groups, including rural Vermont and NOFA Vermont. On our website, it says 24, but we have all the NOFA chapters as our members, and that added up to 30 groups. And between all of our members, we cover all of the states in the US. Some of our members also work in the various territories. through La Via Campesina, we're connected internationally. There is another member of La Via Campesina that we work very closely with on the fishery side called the World Forum of Fisher People that connects us to millions of fishing people, over 10 million fishing people from across the globe, primarily in the global south. And we are all working on similar things. We all have identified similar strategies. There are similar challenges, similar opportunities. We try to come together as often as we can. We're currently organizing for a World Forum of Fisher People gathering in Brazil in November. There is a gathering of international food providers through the NILENI process that's going to happen in 2025. There's a lot that is on the cusp of coming together that can help us demonstrate our power and our collective power. And Henry also mentioned the word peasant in the U.S. has a whole different meaning. It's almost looked down upon. But in the rest of the world, the peasants are valued because of the role that they play in the food system. And so one of the things that we're working on doing is try to have this shared narrative so that when we talk about peasants, we're not dismissed as people who are trying to deal with, you know, tiny little pockets of food providers, but actually millions of people who grow and catch and raise food that the rest of us eat. And so even that vocabulary to not only have a common vocabulary, but also a common fight is part of what we do. Here in the US, we do work on federal policies that connect all of our members. We have two kind of, our work is in, has a kind of a nested element to it. We have two uber goals as an organization. One is ending corporate domination of our food system. And the way we're focusing on that is to address the issue of land grabs and land access for farmers and how much of land has been usurped by those with political power and financial access. And then the other is about economic empowerment, which has to do with fair prices and having a seat at the table when it comes to what farmers are getting paid. For example, trying to change the formula for cost of production, which right now really only has to do with inputs on the farm. And we feel that there's a whole slew of other factors that affect the farmer's ability to make a living, their mortgage on their house, health insurance, clothes, food for their family. These farmers farmers and fishers, frankly, are so intertwined with their lives that you can't separate those things from each other. A few years ago, we actually added up all the real costs that a farmer has, particularly a dairy farmer, which are most impacted by this economic injustice. And so having a policy around this concept of supply management. I don't know if folks are familiar with the supply management concept. I'm going to pause for a minute to see if that's something that has that rings a bell for folks. I'm seeing Jennifer go like this and one person is going like this. And Harry, the supply management is essentially a policy that right now, the way food is produced, particularly dairy, it's just focused on volume and you're just pumping out milk essentially. And supply management is about producing only what you know you can sell. And then on top of that, you are making sure that the milk that you are producing, regardless of where it's ending up, you're getting your cost of production for it. We have actually a really good policy primer. It's called Milk from Family Dairies Act, which I'll see if I can multitask and find it and put a link to it in here. That really gets you into the concept of supply management. We also have a couple of videos about this concept on our website. Very short videos, 3-4 minutes. There's one animated one that I can even pause and show if you think that that would be helpful for folks. Would that be helpful?
If you like, yeah, that sounds great if you're into it.
All right, yeah, let me find it. I think that would be good to, you can give me sharing powers.
Yes. And I'm going to try to give you also speaker sharing power, which I think is a different button. Is that right?
Oh, I have
audio settings.
She should already.
All right, so here it is. I will play it for you. And then I can also play a quick video about our land work, which actually always brings me to tears. So here we go.
Feel free to cozy up with me and see this shit.
Wait, what did I do? Was the sound coming through?
No, you stopped.
Okay.
No, too.
That's what I realized. I didn't press the button that says make the sound come along with it. Let's see here. We'll try this again. Share sound. There we go. Not working.
It's not playing yet.
Oh, why is it not working? Oh, it says it's. Oh, you know why I think it's happening? Maybe is it because it's recording? I'm not sure. It says your screen sharing is paused, and I'm not sure why it's paused.
Let me Google it from my end, and maybe I can share it.
Oh, here. Let me put the. I'll put the link in there for you.
Okay.
Did that work?
Yes. Okay. Now I will share my screen.
Great.
And including audio. There. Okay. Your sound. All right. Amazing. Here we go. Thank you for your patience.
All right.
Crises like pandemics and climate change are directly impacting the farmers and fishers who provide and harvest our food. They are exposing the disparities in our current food system, a system that isn't working for farmers or for you. We all have a right to access food that is nutritious, culturally appropriate, and sustainably grown, raised, and caught.
Yeah, the screen
health,
isn't being shared.
Vibrant community,
wow.
Ecological
right.
restoration, and
you have to press a few sharing buttons sometimes.
It's working for us. I can see it.
Okay, yeah, it's working for me.
Yeah, and me too.
Screen at the top.
It already is. Yeah, it's working on our end. So I'm gonna keep.
I'm seeing it too. Yeah.
But if we are going to realize the right to food and move our food system from disparity to parity, we need policies that guarantee fair prices and living wages for all food providers. Parity is the idea that family farmers, ranchers, and fishers should be paid fair prices for their crops, livestock, and fish that reflect the true costs of food production. More broadly, parity means that the supply of agricultural products and seafood from producer to consumer should be managed responsibly and sustainably. Right now, farmers have no control over the price they receive for their products. Prices for commodity crops, livestock, and seafood are set in global commodities markets and by giant transnational agribusiness and seafood companies. and the prices aren't even based on what it costs to raise, catch, or grow our food. To earn enough money, farmers often increase their production, but this leads to overproduction, which wastes resources and food and actually drives down prices further. Across rural America, family farms, ranches, and fishing boats, as well as small businesses, are shutting down, while large agribusinesses are pocketing billions of dollars. Another consequence of overproduction is that it provides animal feed processors with lots of cheap grain. This in turn props up the polluting factory farm industry. Thousands of smaller, more diversified farms have been replaced by these factory farms and by giant farms that grow only one or two commodity crops. The impacts on family farmers, the quality of our food, and the health of our planet have been devastating. Ultimately, disparity threatens our ability to feed ourselves in a healthy way and to be resilient in the face of crises like the pandemic and the growing threat of climate change. The good news is there are practical and viable solutions. Establishing price floors or a minimum price for what farmers, ranchers, and fishers provide would be equivalent to a fair minimum wage for workers and would provide producers with stable and fair incomes. Price floors, along with responsible supply management, would also stop the cycle of overproduction and reduce the amount of cheap grain available to factory farms. And when farmers don't have to use all of their land to grow crops, they can rest parcels of land. They can rotate their crops, which reduces soil erosion, increases soil productivity and biodiversity on the farm, and makes farmland more resilient to pests and extreme weather. Change is possible. We can transform our food system by paying farmers, ranchers, fishers, and workers fair prices and a living wage, but only if corporate control over our system is dismantled. To learn more about how you can support Parity for Family Farmers, visit disparitytoparity.org.
Thanks for queuing that up. After, as we were starting to watch it, I realized it was actually not the video I was thinking about, because we have a whole video, a short one on supply management. I'm going to put that link. We don't have to play it. I'm going to put that link in the chat that I encourage folks to watch that when you have a few minutes. All of these videos are very short and they're meant to sort of drive the point home, hopefully, in a concise way. And the website that was cited at the end, the Disparity to Parity Project, is a project we launched in the midst of COVID, actually, that is that includes a whole bunch of essays. And we're not talking about only academic essays. In this case, we're looking to farmers and other food providers as experts here. And I'm trying to break that tendency to only think about expertise as academia. And so if you go on that website, you'll find a whole bunch of essays around things like supply management, around building power, around land access, and other factors that from our standpoint has led to the disparities that we're all experiencing. I'm also just curious, have people heard the word parity often before? Is that okay, so you're all ahead of me, because I remember attending NACWA Family Farm Coalition meetings as a board member and hearing the word parity just thrown around. And I thought, what does that mean? It was foreign to me. I didn't understand it. And it wasn't until I suddenly used it in a sentence and was thinking, oh, so parity is the opposite of disparity, that I suddenly just realized what it meant and its implications. So this whole disparity to parity is really not only about our economic empowerment work, but because all of these things are so interconnected, it's also about our work to end corporate domination of our food system, since the price is often controlled by the corporate players. And there's also essays on there about land. I do want to show, if you don't mind, just want to talk a little bit about our land work And if you don't mind playing this one, and I'll just warn everybody, this, I don't know why I get emotional with this video all the time, but I do, and I hope it resonates with you as well. So this is the next video, Jennifer, if you don't mind playing that. And for those who are not able to see it, you can, you have the links here.
Sure, got it.
I'm here, I'm blessed to be a farmer. But I can't say I'm where I'm at because of me. It's because of the three generations before me. And if you can understand that, you can keep going.
Black farmers and landowners have faced a well-documented history of systemic racism at the hands of the United States Department of Agriculture.
There's so much pain in the black farming community, and starting with land, with land loss. People almost can't hear you when you don't, if you don't start with that.
First, we have to secure land for black farmers, for black landowners. When their land is secure, they have to maintain it. And the only way to maintain it is there are fair prices.
One of the hardest things for an heirs property owner to do is to get on their land. Most of the time, the title or the deed that the family owns is flawed or is not clear. In the case of heirs property, multiple people are on the deed. And when it comes to getting electric or water from the county or the city, this is almost impossible because what they're looking for is a specific person, one individual, to bill and held accountable for the services being connected. When the title is flawed or not clear, that is also a sign to outside people to try to come in and capitalize and steal the land.
After you get past land and land loss and figuring out how to deal with that, then it's this issue of credit, of having access to credit and being treated fairly around credit. If you get past that, it's this issue about the debt that's out there and how do you get past this debt? We're always fighting from behind.
There's not a lot of accessibility for farm workers, for a community of color, for the Latinos, about farmland. Even though we have open spaces like this, an area about 56 acres that you can see, is not available for community. We want to make it available, creating, you know, farming co-ops.
It's so important that we keep this conversation in the context of what's going on today. Right now, with all this unrest and these protests, the center of all of it has been about unfair treatment, about inequities, inequality. It's been about police brutality.
We have to change society and we have to make it more equitable.
Our journey for social justice has always included protest, and it allows us to bring a social consciousness.
Thank you, Jennifer. So the reason I wanted to play those videos is, again, the interconnectedness of all the work that we do. And then what are we doing when the rubber meets the road, you know, in real time? We have been working with our members and allies to introduce pieces of legislation in the context of the Farm Bill. Of course, we all probably know it's unlikely that the Farm Bill will get passed this year. We don't know what's going to happen during the lame duck session. But as one of our policy people said, it's kind of pencils down time right now in DC. But having said that, We do have a piece of legislation called Fair Credit for Farmers Act, which is intended to open up financial resources to farmers. This video was focused on Black farmers, but as the Federation folks say, they also recognize that this is not unique to Black farmers. Young farmers, small-scale white farmers, other farmers, the Latinx farmers, as you heard, are also having a hard time accessing either land or credit and economic support. There is another piece of legislation called Farmland for Farmers Act, which is intended to give more access to land, as the name suggests. So there's a whole suite of legislation that we've been working on. As I mentioned, there is the Milk from Family Dairies Act, which we've been working really hard to get a member of Congress to support. We have had conversations with the Vermont delegation and others to get that introduced, but it seems like the National Dairy Council has a pretty strong hold on members of Congress. So any change in dairy seems to be hitting a lot of roadblocks at the moment. But one of the ways we want to practice our power is, and this is not about showing up in DC, it's about amplifying these narratives. Why is it that we need access to credit and financial resources for farmers? Why is there even a land access issue? We have a campaign that is focused on ending unjust investments in land that are taking land away from farmers. We have a report I'll share with all of you called Selling Out the Delta. I'll put the link in the chat here. And this report came about because as we look, as we looked into who is owning the land, who is making these investments, who is essentially taking advantage of the vulnerabilities that farmers have. And there's a, I think they call it, the five B's: divorce, disaster, death, disability, and debt. When those five things are present, the predatory behavior that you heard on the video comes to play. Many of these players are hedge funds, and this particular report and campaign is focused on the role TIAA plays, which is the teachers. I always forget what the acronym stands for, but a lot of our retirement funds is invested in through TIAA that actually wraps itself in a cloak of green by suggesting that it's a socially responsible fund, but it's actually using the fund to grab land, and it's become one of the biggest landowners in the U.S. And so this campaign is a global campaign in conjunction with not only organizations here in the U.S., but with the land loss workers in Brazil and the Canadian organization Grain. And it's a wide range of folks that are coming together to stop not only what TIAA is doing, but we know that we can stop one company and we could be opening the door for another company. So this is really just about putting barriers on those who are not farmers themselves, the equivalent of absentee landlords, buying land and repurposing it for their own financial gain as opposed to for its intended use of growing food for our communities. And then there is a whole movement within, are folks here familiar with the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance? Is that a network that you've heard about, some of you? We got somebody in the back. So yeah, that's just to know about it. So this is a network that we do a lot of our power building and organizing through. And it is the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance that is working on this global gathering that we refer to as NILENI, and that is going to be happening. We're not exactly sure what the location is going to be, but it'll be happening in 2025. And so this is just an example of campaigns that are somewhat local, regional, national, but really deeply connected to the international fight for taking back our food system. And we talk about our language often. We want to make sure that what we do here doesn't come across as if we are trying to keep food from getting to folks elsewhere. That's really not what this fight is about. It's really about empowering people who provide food wherever they live to be able to do so without corporate domination and without essentially economic blackmail. And so the campaign is, yes, we are trying to stop some of the trade policies from happening, not because we don't want to feed people overseas, but because we feel people overseas can feed themselves if we only give them their land back, their fishing rights back, their seeds back, and their political power back. So this is really about self-determination and about sovereignty and not about xenophobia or trying to alienate anybody who might need food, and which is often how we are cast as people. Well, you're going to stop this trade. You're going to stop feeding people in Africa. Why is it that people in Africa are having a hard time finding food? It's because most of the land has been grabbed. Most of the crops has been dominated, and most of the economic system has been usurped by others. So this kind of is the interconnectedness of all of our work, not only here domestically, but also internationally. I wanted to then touch really briefly, and then I'll stop and see if you wanted to have any discussion points on this connection between land and sea. One of the main visible places where that's playing itself out is in aquaculture, which is fish farming, essentially, or growing fish, growing seaweed, growing shellfish on farms at sea or on land, which in and of itself can be quite productive and quite benign. But much like animal farms on land with pigs and chickens and cows, farms at sea are turning into CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. And so we're seeing factory fish farms out at sea raising salmon and other fish. We're even seeing factory scale farming happening around seaweed and in some cases, even oysters. So we're trying to make sure that we have farming at sea that is about the appropriately scaled, and it's done by small and mid-scale farmers, just like the same that we advocate for on land. One of the interesting things about fish farming is one of the biggest advocates for industrializing factory fish farming are the same folks we're fighting on land. It's Cargill, who is trying to find a different source for their soybeans. So it's not good enough for them that we're keeping pigs and chickens in captivity that are eating their soybeans that is raised in land that's deforested in Brazil. Now they want to take that soybean and create a new market for it. In this case, they want to feed it to fish being held in captivity. And same with JBS is one of the entities that's involved in factory fish farming. ConAgra is involved. And so there is, in fact, one of the biggest coalitions supporting factory fish farming was chaired until recently by Cargill, until we exposed it. And suddenly Cargill is only kind of one of the board members, and they have a fishing industry person chairing it. So the similarities between land and sea are becoming more and more vivid as industrial agriculture is finding other places to exert their power and energy and extract financial resources. And in the meanwhile, further distancing us from our source of food and on economic sustainability, not to mention environmental and an ecological sustainability. Right now, I'm headed to Kentucky. That's what I'm doing on a train for our annual meeting, where we're going to be talking about our next strategic plan. And these campaigns that I've talked about are likely going to take center stage. Our members are also talking about the need for us to tackle climate change. So we're going to try to see what is in our DNA that gives us an opportunity to work on climate change in a way that we're adding to the existing fights, as opposed to adding something new, adding something that no one else is working on to the fight for a just climate. So hopefully by the time in a week or so from now, we'll have some sense of what our organization is going to be working on over the next 5 years. All right, so let me pause there for a minute and see if you want to dive into anything a little bit.
Sure. If anyone has a question that they want to put in the chat, otherwise you can raise your hand or speak out. My mind is reeling because so much of what you're talking about is so relevant to what we do here. And I guess I could make a comment. Maybe there's some questions in here, but and we've got a question behind. But what we work in, most of the people on this call right now work for our conservation district or are affiliated with it, to be honest. Some folks aren't, but a lot of us are. And we really work to assist farmers in getting access to state and federal conservation programs and sometimes private programs. What I've seen is, I mean, there's just so much siloing in the way that farmers get money, which is
absolutely
a huge issue, and the redundancy of paperwork and the bureaucracy, it's a nightmare. What we're facing right now in terms of, I mean, you brought up corporate land grabs. And you know, I wonder, one question that I have for you is, in your work, do you come against some of these global conservation policies, especially, you know, the even including the oceans, there's a global, you know, policy to conserve 50% of the world by 2050, including the oceans. And, you know, we see that as a huge risk of corporate land grabs. That's what it's been. So I'd love to hear your thinking on that. But then also when you were talking about parity, we deal in, again, the federal and state conservation programs, but also what is called risk management, AKA crop insurance. And what really stands out to me about the way the USDA defines risk and risk management, they don't take the natural resources or natural world into account at all. And so even though, you know, we know that planting a nice healthy buffer and cover crop and, you know, diversification decreases your production risk and your weather related risks and your human risk, you know, it decreases almost all the different categories of risk, but it's not integrated into that program. I should stop there, but I also just wanted to plug, you know, the conservation district infrastructure as that local decision-making body for natural resources. I think speaking for everybody who deals with us, you know, we believe in it in terms of like, a residence of a watershed having a say-so in the natural resources of their community. And it really boundaries, not borders, if you know what I mean. So,
I do know what you mean. And thanks for putting all that out there. I hear you on the 50% global saving the world by saving 50%, when we know that so much of that came out of the UN World Food Agenda that happened, started about 3 years ago. And we actually built as much opposition to that as we could because we saw the writing on the wall. And I think we need to, all of us collectively, keep our eyes on that process and push back. I think there is a lot of greenwashing happening in that process, a lot of blue washing happening in that process. And there's a lot of narrative hijacking that's happening in that process. And so how can we keep ourselves organized? And that's where some of the work with the one of our staff really works closely on keeping his eyes on the UN process and the Committee for Food Security, and the there's another committee that we try to keep our eyes on to try to organize around that's focused on Indigenous people and civil society. And so we're trying our best to keep our eyes on what's happening and activate people and be proactive about it. Because by the time we hear about something that has happened and we need to react to it, we're behind already, and we're not as resourceful, and I mean that mostly financially, as the other side, so to speak. And so how do we get ahead of things and really keep our ears to the ground? In terms of the siloing of things, particularly around the issues you mentioned with the USDA, this is such a universal problem. Somehow, I don't understand when and how agencies in charge of our well-being, however way you want to, federal agencies in charge of our well-being, have gotten to the point of not recognizing the neck bones connected to the head bone. You know, there is this issue of with fisheries, for instance, fish are managed in single species, absent of the environment within which they live. So to give you an example, here in the Northeast, we've heard a lot about cod and haddock being caught, for instance, being in trouble. Yet the federal agencies allow for huge amounts of the cod's food to be extracted through factory fishing operations. And then on top of that, they refuse to get involved in other things that affect the fish populations, such as watershed health, for instance, and industries that are polluting the water that ends up in the bays, that ends up in the ocean, that ends up affecting estuaries. So this disconnect seems to be universal, and I think it is it's a way that the agencies have been co-opted. We have a lot of farmers and fishers who get upset with things and say we just need to do away with government, and our point always that we can't do away with government. We need to do away with corporate control of our government, because most of these policies have come because corporations and I also recognize that most of the farmers and fishers we work with are technically incorporated. So when we're talking about corporations, we're really talking about mega corporations have found ways to control things to their benefit. And so how do we build our power? How do we continue to connect these dots so that we can see each other's fights as our own fights and not allow them to silo us the way they have siloed the issues that we're tackling? And that to me is the only way we can undo some of the damage and prevent some of the other ones that are coming down the pike. I see, yes, so the NFFC priorities for the new, I hope that kind of got to some of what you were bringing up, Jennifer, and there's more to be said for that for sure. I'll put into the chat our Farm Bill toolkit that we have around the issues that we're trying to get through the Farm Bill process. As I mentioned earlier, the Fair Credit for Farmers Act was one of those. The Farmland for Farmers Act is another one of those. Let me pull that up and I'll put that in the chat for you as soon as I find it. The problem obviously is that we are in a moment of sort of a pause, if you will, when it comes to the Farm Bill. We don't know what will happen. As I mentioned earlier during the lame duck session, what we hope is that the current Farm Bill, because it is highly flawed, will not go through, and chances are that it won't, and that the conversation will get picked up again in 2025 after the new Congress takes their seat. The new members and existing members often ask for those who have an opinion to introduce new topics. So anything that we didn't get a marker bill in, which is some of the bills that we worked that I mentioned are those marker bills, we can then bring back up again, hopefully in March or February or March. Actually in February, we'll do our fly-in and take our farmers to DC and not only encourage members of Congress to reintroduce these bills in the context of the new Farm Bill, but also some of our priorities that were not included in the existing farm bill. And we can, I will, like I said, I'll share with you take action documents that we have around the farm bill and the various bills that we are, that we had been promoting in the context of the farm bill that again is currently on pause. And yes, Real Organic, I agree. We do collaborate with them here and there. Say more about the concerns with the UN Food Program. It's not so much the UN Food Program. It was as a whole, as its entirety. But a few years ago, there was the UN launched this, losing the names a little bit. I'm getting old. I'm forgetting things. UN Food Security. The Food System Summit. Thank you, Didi. And we actually ended up organizing what we call the People's Kitchen Counter Summit. And some of those videos are also on our, the videos of that gathering is on our YouTube page. Because we were concerned, as I said earlier, we could kind of see based on what we were hearing, who was in control, even the person who was chairing was challenging that there was any validity to the concerns folks were bringing up. And so we had to get organized and we had to put our issues out there. I'm going to put the, let me see if I can find it here, and I'll put the, oh, here we go. So here's, there's a few videos I'm going to share with you around that UN Food Summit. This is one of them. Here's another one. We did four, and from different perspectives. The first one I put in there, the Indigenous food sovereignty perspective. The second one that I'm putting in there is about land rights and food sovereignty. This is that one that I just put in there. This third one is about the African perspective on the UN Food System Summit. This is the third one. And our train just got going, so I'm hoping I won't lose connection. And the fourth one, which I probably should have put on there first, is sort of an introduction and a welcome to the People's Kitchen Counter Summit. So those four will help you dive a little bit deeper into our concerns with the UN Food System Summit and what has emerged from it. And I think it kind of, this conversation makes me think we need to do a follow-up on that to talk about what has happened and why we need to continue to push our counter mobilization.
Didi, do you have any follow-ups to your questions or context you wanted to give?
Well, I guess, I mean, both with the Food System Summit and also with the 30 by 30 initiative, you know, it's easy to see why it could be something very good. And it's very hard to talk, you know, to find ways to talk about those subtleties. And so I'm just actually, yeah, hoping that you might have some language or more specific examples. Because I'm one of those people, I don't like to trash one thing or another, but I do want to educate people about the fact that it's not as simple as it seems, you know? And I think that is really important work to be able to stay on that line. Anyway, so I'm just looking for your perspective.
Absolutely. And I often tell people that I don't want to leave a conversation making people think that I just call them stupid. I want to leave them thinking, oh, wow, I didn't even think about that. So how do we have those thoughtful conversations? That's like a whole 3-hour narrative training, essentially. There's so many elements to how to talk about these issues without letting our anger and our frustration and our concerns get the better of us, which often does. You know, we get into these spaces often hearing people lose their cool. And so we spend a lot of time trying to train our farmers, our fishermen, our ranchers to, in fact, at the meeting we're having in Kentucky next week, we have a whole session on communications and narrative, because these issues don't happen only when the UN does some, they're constant. And they're like this thing that's just constantly jabbing. There's another one and another one and another one. And when you have all these other stresses happening in your life, how do you say something rational in the face of all of this? So I don't know if I could pass on anything in a few minutes. I feel like we could have a whole conversation organized, which I think that would be a really good thing to do, a whole conversation organized around how do you talk about these things without seeming like, without being called a wingnut, essentially, and a naysayer and a whatever else they, that we can get called by folks who want to marginalize our voices. And so if there's an interest in that and having that narrative conversation, there's no shortage of resources and people who are working on that, and we can work on putting something together.
That would be great. Yeah.
We need
okay. Wait, the thunderstorm right here. In terms of the 30 by 30, is there anything that you want to expand on there that of examples or kind of?
Well, to be honest, we haven't really focused on 30 by 30 that much. To the extent that we have is in our collaboration with the environmental justice movement, which mm-hmm. we do a lot of work with, particularly around issues that have to do with industrial production that affects particularly communities of color. And obviously a lot of those are pesticide manufacturing facilities or toxic waste facilities. And so us as an organization haven't really taken a deep dive into that. But there are organizations who are. There is one that has been doing, taking something that might seem like we want to fight and making some good out of it. And the Coming Clean Collaborative, actually, I don't think they're called a collaborative anymore in their name, but Coming Clean really is an environmental justice health alliance, have done some really good work on focusing on what can be taken from the 30 by 30 in order to empower the environmental justice communities.
Well, we need to look into that. I think Coming Clean is out of Vermont.
It is.
National. Yeah.
Yeah, they're national. Yeah, their staff are based in Brattleboro.
Okay. So I had a quick question about all of these cooperatives that you all work with. We don't have a strong cooperative producers culture in Vermont, other outside of Cabot and some really large dairy conglomerates that are cooperatives. What, in your experience, are the factors that need to be in place in order to establish effective regional cooperatives?
It's interesting that you say that, because seems like cooperatives is something that used to exist a lot, and I hear about it a lot in the Northeast. And then something happened and we lost that cooperation amongst food providers. The main cooperative organization that we work with is Federation of Southern Cooperatives. That's the video that you saw. It's a primarily Black-led cooperative. And it's kind of it does two things. It focuses on marketing and it focuses on land access. And I think it is, those two things are the two major elements that these farmers have in common, and not in a good way. Not a lack of access to land is something they have all in common. And this issue of heirs property that you learn about, there's that common struggle that has brought them together. And then the common opportunity of collective marketing is what brought them together. So I think that identification of something that can benefit the entire group that you're trying to bring together. On the fishing side, we don't take federal funding, but a few years ago, the USDA kind of literally begged us, would you just take this $10,000 and help start this co-op? Because we helped pilot the concept of community-supported fisheries, stole it from community-supported agriculture. And And so we had proven that there is something there that we could create. And they wanted to tap into this interest from Chatham and the Cape of fishermen who wanted to come together. And they had one thing in common. They wanted to get fair prices for their catch. Some of the fish that people buy at, let's say, Whole Foods for $24.99 a pound, fishermen are getting paid maybe $2 a pound for. And so this co-op is called the Chatham Harvesters Co-op, was created for one of the first co-ops that was created for the for getting fair prices for the fishermen. So fair price is the common denominator. So I'm bringing these examples up because what I'm learning is that what is the common thing, whether the struggle or the opportunity that the group has that they want to achieve together, that feels like the number one thing we need to identify. The lobstermen, for instance, have a co-op because there is a Canadian company called Cook that they do what's called pounding lobsters. They catch all the lobsters, they hold them, feed them antibiotics to keep them for a long time. And then the market, when the prices go really high, they flood the market with them and the prices crash. So the lobstermen are creating a co-op, created a co-op in order to maintain a steady price for themselves. So if you can identify that common denominator that a group of people want to address together, that's the first step, it feels like to me. And it doesn't always have to be a good thing. It can be, we're all going to get together and cooperate to fight this, or we're all going to get together and create a new system of getting a fair price for our catch. I prefer to work towards something that has hope in it, that is not about fighting, because we have enough fighting going on in our movement, that if we can create co-ops that are about hope and are about creating new systems, I feel like, thank you. I feel like that gives us something tangible to hang our hope on. There is a national organization called the New Economy Coalition. Are you familiar with that at all? So the New Economy Coalition is really focused on the concept of cooperatives. So a lot of the organizations that are part of NEC are Cooperation Jackson is one of those organizations. And I think a couple of years ago, when we were working with Rural Vermont and others to get the agroecology school concept, which I saw somebody from here is on the agroecology school work, Cooperation Jackson and others were up there to talk about their work. So there's a whole movement that can help you think through, how do you put one together? What are the questions you want to ask? What kind of co-op do you want to build? Is it a producer's co-op? Is it a buyer's co-op? Is it a combination of both? Because that tells you even which direction you need to take and what kind of legal system you want to build in order for that co-op to meet the purpose or achieve the purpose. I remember when we were setting up a co-op in Bristol, Rhode Island, that was the first question that came to us is, what is your common thing you want to accomplish and whose co-op is this? So whose co-op is it going to be? Is it going to be the buyers? Is it going to be the sellers? There's a whole different set of rights for buyers versus sellers. Is it a combination of both? Is it a shareholders co-op? So there's a lot of things you have to think about in order to actually get that ball rolling. And there are organizations, there's the Cooperative Development Institute that's based in the Northeast that provides those sort of trainings and tools for folks who want to start co-ops. There's actually the Cooperative Development Services that used to be out of Vermont. I don't even know if they're still around. The person who I knew there was out of Burlington. So there's not a shortage of entities who can get your thinking going if there is a real interest in getting a community-based co-op moving in Vermont, whether amongst a group of farmers or a group of eaters.
Yeah, there's also the Solidarity Economy Law Center. It's a great resource for that kind of stuff. Niaz, I've been trying to get a hold of Sharday Neighbors at the New Economy Coalition and trying to get someone from their team onto this Dirt and Democracy series. Mm-hmm. So if there's anybody you can connect us with, I think we'd like to have the opportunity to take an introductory dive with them and possibly set up some further training.
Yeah, happy to. We're a member of the New Economy Coalition, so we might have a little leverage to get a conversation going. So I'm happy to connect the two of you to the NEC staff.
Are there any other questions from the crowd? I
missed a lot.
Go ahead, Henry.
I just wanted to ask Niaz, like, if there's a, you know, all of this work that you're doing on sort of a continent-wide scale, is there either ways that we can get involved in that work with you formally, or are there things that we can be doing on the ground to increase community control and decrease corporate control over our food systems that you can identify from your vantage?
Sorry, the voice of the announcer kind of drowned you out a little bit, Henry, but I think what I heard. Sorry, you guys.
It's not even coming through your speaker, so it's okay.
It's sort of ringing in my ear. I think what I heard you say, Henry, is how people can get involved. First of all, I promised that I was going to find the Farm Bill toolkit that gets into the various elements that we were interested in. This is the Farm Bill toolkit that I just put in the chat for folks. So obviously that's one way to get involved is, you know, with your members of Congress, senators and representatives, to have them support these various pieces of legislation. That's one way to get involved. It went away. I just pulled up another thing to share with you all. Let me see if I can find it again. Well, no, it's not coming up. So I think those are the, right now, the political moments translate themselves in policy change. And policy change comes in four different ways. Everybody only thinks of, when we talk policy change, people think about federal policy. We're going to pass legislation. That's not the only place where policy happens. Policy happens in what they call the administrative law. That's when, you know, really Congress lays out its intentions, the agencies work on an administrative level to write those, to essentially interpret what Congress wanted them to do. And unfortunately, a lot of us don't have access to that administrative law process, but that is a way to also get engaged in policy. The other kind of policy change that I find to be more productive, because it is, we're often told that we don't have enough power. We're not representing enough and power is often defined in money. You don't have enough money behind you. So changing policies of institutions that are buying our food, changing policies of hospitals in Vermont, for instance. I know the University of Vermont in Burlington has done a lot of work on changing their food purchasing. The healthcare system, these numbers are about a decade old, so my guess is that the number is much higher. At one point, was spending $12 billion on food and beverage in North America alone. Imagine if more and more of that was funneled towards farms that are your neighbors and fishermen that are your neighbors. That's the kind of policy change that actually translates to power. And we've seen that happen when we've gone to members of Congress with just farmers and fishermen. They've said, well, you know, your farm is too small, your boat isn't worth enough. And then we go with a couple of hospitals in tow and a couple of universities in tow who say, we actually spend this many millions of dollars on farm products and seafood, and we want to see these kind of folks supported, and therefore we want you to support this kind of legislation. That kind of power that translates into money has taken us a long way when it comes to policy change. So you can, if you have that opportunity to work with organizations that are doing institutional policy changes when it comes to purchasing policies, even working with an organization, there's a national organization called the Good Food Purchasing Network that is working on even city level policies, municipal policies, when it comes to purchasing food. Every one of those steps is a policy change that builds upon the other and the other and the other. And it gives us more power when we go to DC to try to change that federal level policy. Gives us more power when we go to intervene at the United Nations and say, these are the farmers you need to support, these are the fishermen you need to support, because we're no longer just going by ourselves. We're not going with the healthcare system behind us, with the education system behind us. So those to me are things that are tangible, they're bite-sized, they can happen on your community level. I'll give you another. If any of you work in a university setting, one of the campaigns that we're involved with TIAA that I mentioned earlier is to get the vestment campaigns going. Change the policies of your university or your workplace that dictates where your retirement money goes, and make sure that those policies don't take your retirement money and invest it in land grabbing. That is policy work that has really major implications on what we are trying to do in the long haul. So there's a lot of different ways to take action. It really depends on what is the one thing you each want to do. And I often, in addition to trying not to make people feel like I'm being hostile towards anything, as we were talking about with Didi, I also don't want to overwhelm anybody. You know, I have this thought of everybody should be sufficiently well. So what's the one thing that you can take on that has the power to change, but it doesn't make you feel like I took more than I should have and now I can't do anything anymore? One of the things I've seen as a community activist more than anything else as a community organizer is organizers getting burnt out because they did too much too fast because they cared. And so how do you temper yourself? How do you take on the one thing that for you is the easiest, but it has a really big impact in the greater scheme of things? Every one of those opportunities I mentioned plays a role in the bigger work that we do.
I have to throw in here, because we're talking about policy, that like for us at the conservation district level, the most powerful thing that we can do is interact through the local working group, which is chaired by the local conservation district, set up our local funding pools between our district and Michael's district. We're channeling $2 million into our communities. It has to be spent in our community on the practices that our community chose through our community engagement. So that's just huge. Get involved at the local level. Sorry, Didi, go ahead.
That's policy change,
no,
right?
It's really important. Yeah. Oh, I was just gonna say, when you said universities, I thought you were gonna go somewhere else. I will say that I come from a family of teachers, and the returns in TIAA are, you know, it's like 15-20% returns right now. It's crazy how much money is being made in TIA. But when you said university, I thought you were going to talk about the cafeteria food, Cisco
too.
And all of that, and public schools, you know, the school lunches. It's like a huge opportunity, I think, for not only changing the food system, but changing the health and ability to think of the whole upcoming generation.
Absolutely. There was a very active campaign. I'm going to change headsets here because I talked too long and my headset is fine. There was a whole active campaign through an organization called Real Food Challenge that was focused on university. We did a kind of a tiered approach to institutional purchasing. We started with the healthcare sector for a couple of reasons. One is we knew them
We knew the people involved with an organization called Healthcare Without Harm, which is also has folks in Brattleboro. It's a lot of Vermont connections here in this movement. And also because we knew that decision-making with the healthcare, with the hospitals, was going to be a lot easier than decision-making with universities. In universities, you need student activism to move things. In the healthcare sector, you just need to convince the head of purchasing. And I'll give you one example. We went to Boston Children's Hospital a few years ago, and they are known for, you know, having good food in their cafeterias now. And on their menu, they have the name of every farm that they're getting stuff from. So we said, where is the name of the boat? Because they also have seafood. So we never thought about that. So we asked them, well, can you ask for the name of the boat? They took that as a, all right, we're going to go ask for the name of the boat. And when their distributor wouldn't give them the name of the boat, they decided something's wrong with this picture and changed distributors overnight. On a university level, we have to go through student activism and resolutions and all of these things. So we wanted to kind of build power in layers. We started with the healthcare sector. Once we had enough healthcare facilities who had bought into our asks, we went to universities. Once we had enough universities, we started to work with the National Farm to Cafeteria Network to go to K through 12. Because ultimately, our goal is to feed the ones who are most vulnerable, and that is K through 12. But the system isn't made for us to get good food into that process. And so we needed to kind of build it from the bigger players down to the K through 12. And that's what it took for us to get there.
Yeah, I have a question and a comment. Like 10, 15 years ago, I tried to do that at our local school. And what I learned there was that if they don't take the crappy government surplus food, that they lose a lot of their funding. So that was really interesting to learn that. So, I suppose they don't have to feed it, but that is part of their budget. But I'm curious why with a university, why you couldn't just go to the head of purchasing? Why do you say you need... Why is that different than a hospital? Why do you need the student activism there?
That's just what we learned, was that that was the way to get to the university administration. It was they needed it to come from the student body for some reason. Why? Okay. I don't know. But yeah. The hospitals, we had direct access to the purchasing. The University of Vermont in Burlington, the person they hired, my goodness, I'm totally forgetting everybody's names. She came on board back in the, I would say the early 2010s, and is known as the person who revolutionized food and healthcare systems.
Yeah, and we some of us here know her. She was I wrote about that long ago, but yeah, I'm blinking on her name too, but Jennifer, she was at our Landcare Congress.
She's great. We've worked with her quite a bit, and she was really approachable, reachable. But we go to a university food purchasing person, and you get something completely different. You are actually told that we're not going through the channels that they would typically work through. Diane Emery. That's who she is. Yeah.
There's one more question in the chat. I can read it out loud. Okay. So how can we bring parity back the way it existed in the early 1900s? Can we do this through farm bill reform? We need parity for all raw materials that also consider the externalities of the extraction of those raw materials. But manufacturers want to keep raw materials cheap.
That's right. There is actually work being done through this whole disparity to parity campaign to bring back some of the policies. It was, I think, 1950s or something that policy got yanked. So that was part of our goal with that project, is to, in the context of the Farm Bill and some of the fair prices legislation that we've been working on, is rooted in this concept of getting parity back. The whole Milk from Family Dairies Act, that's the one that I wanted to put in the chat. That is based on, it is one way we're trying to get parity back, but it's very much focused on the dairy sector, as the raw product being dairy. Hang on, let me find.
Yeah, and while you're looking, I guess I'd love to throw in there, if parity, if the goal really is cost of production plus profit that a farmer actually has, you know, makes up for what it costs to farm and makes a profit, which I think is a completely reasonable thing that we should be demanding for people who grow our food. Just because you're talking to a bunch of conservationists, like we have, you know, it on good record with farms that we work with that the conservation programs are actually what put them into the black. The farms that actually get that federal incentive puts them into the black, but it is completely impossible to do any type of financial planning with these programs. And for the record, it's August 4th and not a single farm in Vermont, and I think in many, many states, have contracts with the USDA yet this year for NRCS programs because of bureaucracy, paperwork, computer programs not functioning, redundancies, and it's ridiculous. And so, you know, I think if my two cents on Farm Bill and conservation programs in general, if this could be a reliable, consistent source of money that, you know, we don't have to apply to 10 different programs every year and just hope. I think, you know, farmers would be a lot better off. There's so much money to be spent on this, but it's a nightmare.
We hear that a lot. It doesn't matter which state, you know, it seems to be a common thing. I just put in another link. I'm just keep sharing links with y'all. Those are the essays that are focused on conservation and environmental resilience and parity from that disparity to parity website. That might give you a little sense of what we're talking about when it comes to particularly, you know, this whole, I want to give you guys one example that really drove this profit versus who has the right to make profit. We, on the fishing side, we had a company that I don't know, I won't mention any names. A company had approached one of our fishing folks saying, we'll pay you whatever you want if you can make sure that you bring us fish that's caught only by hooks, because they considered that to be more ecologically sound. So we took all of his receipts, what his cost of operations, fuel, bait, hooks, insurance, clothes, everything. And we came up with a number and we went to the company and we said, great, this is what it cost me to catch fish for you. They refused to pay them that. They said, no, we'll only pay you $2.50 a pound. And this company is vertically integrated. They have a policy at every point of vertical integration to make an 18% profit. So they have to make 18% at every stage of vertical integration, yet they're not even giving the people who are providing them with the food the opportunity to break even, forget profit, break even. This is the system. They, for some reason, they feel they have a right to make profit. And your job is to just give them the tools they need to make profit. And that, to me, is something we need to shine more light on. And to be able to get some campaigns focused on just exposing what the middle of the chain is doing to this economic system, which is the middle of the chain used to be a service provider. It is now the usurper of power and profit. And so how do we undo that? A lot of the community-based food sovereignty resolutions for places like Maine that they passed, a lot of the community support agriculture, community support fisheries, it's all about putting the middle of the chain back where it needs to be. The co-op I mentioned in Chatham is about eliminating the economic power the seafood distributors have on them. So we need more of that in order for it to be understood that the people who provide you with your raw materials, in this case, food, have just as much right to make a profit and pay for all of their costs as you believe you do. Somehow that's not universally understood.
Truly amazing.
And that's where the peasant comes in. It's like, you're a peasant, you don't deserve a profit. We are the corporation, we deserve the profit. Don't get me started on that one.
Well, so it is 7:35, and yeah, we don't want to open up another. It was just wonderful having you here. Henry, I think you're still on. Do you have a closing remark or anything to say before we conclude?
No, I'm really excited to have heard everything, and I'm glad that we moved into something that's really relevant to our own work, that it's not just corporate price gouging that's messing up land stewards and the working landscape, but also the bureaucracy and all of the crazy waste that's going into administrating money that's supposed to get to farmers and instead being wasted on sometimes on people like us, right? We're trying to cut the fat on a lot of that. So that was good to hear. Among the things we need to think about, but I thought that was great. Thanks. I would like to add that before we just close, that we are going to be welcoming a Chinese professor named Dr. Sit Sui on August 18th. She's involved in the Global University and the Chinese Rural Reconstruction movement, and they have met, they are working with trying to reclaim the agricultural economy and rural economies at a scale way beyond things that we know in the West. And I think she's going to have some very interesting content for us. But yeah, thanks so much, Niaz and Jen and everyone for joining us tonight. I don't know if you guys have any other things you want to say.
No, thank you again. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Really great. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you all. Bye.
Nice to meet you too.
Thank you so much, Mia. It was wonderful.
Thanks, Henry. Bye.